Hey friends, this is an episode of the Fox Wizard podcast, Questing Betwixt, Questing Amidst the Meta Crisis in a Time Betwixt Worlds. I started this podcast and I was in such a dark place seeing the, this was a few years ago, but seeing the trajectory of where the world was happening, and now we've got genocide and all sorts of rubbish happening all about the world. Meta Crisis realized, and yet somehow amongst it all, I seem to be in a post-tragic state, still feeling deeply the angst and anguish that comes from living in these times, and yet also trying to find a pathway through. And this episode is a little experiment. I mean, in my world, I find the most interesting people aren't usually the ones with millions of followers that are, you know, killing it, so to speak, on social media. Instead, they're the ones that are quietly doing quite profound work in the periphery, in the penumbra. And Gregory Dak, whom I'm about to share a conversation with, is one such person. We've been friends for, well, Gregory has been subscribed to the newsletter that I write for, I think, over half a dozen years now. And we've had letter exchanges and conversations over the times. And I remember having a conversation with him and discovering that he has this wonderful blend of a background and growing up quite close to the ritual and ceremony with regards to death, you know, funerals, cemeteries, and so on. And also, and with that comes a lot of grief sensibilities, a lot of wisdom, a lot of warmth, a lot of reverence for life. And he also has deep experience within the world and profession of security. Now, security is something that I've typically perhaps viewed. How would I relate to security? It often feels to me as though people try to optimize security as if it were a closed system. And so that works to a degree, but it never really fully works. And I remember a conversation I had with Gregory where I was asking Greg Dak, you know, about this topic of security. And now Greg has the sensibilities of a complexity practitioner. He's been following my work. He's a kindred spirit. He was saying, you know, there's this paradox where, you know, folks want security, but how secure do we want to be? Because if you can have ultimate security in a town or something, but then turn the whole town into a prison, it's secure, sure, but at what cost? And from Gregory's perspective, the real question is, how do we create the conditions in which we don't need to have sniper towers and other things there, because we've created the conditions where these types of incidences are less likely to occur. And so this naturally goes into the fabric of Gemeinschaft, of neighborly relations, of conviviality, community, you know, the warm relationality that makes for a sense of security. And so I loved that. I loved, you know, the juxtaposition or the alchemy, the synthesis of what seems to be disparate worlds, but of course it isn't. And this fits into the larger conversation around where are we heading and how can we co-create a world more curious and kind and perhaps a future less grim. This is our first time having a conversation on the podcast. I have this thing where I was a bit rusty. I tend to be super, you know, quite friendly and polite. The way that I ask questions is a bit of a cloud as I'm figuring and thinking in draft. And Greg was very patient with me. And I think the result is a warm and insightful conversation. And I think you'll come to really appreciate this and perhaps consider the approach to security, to life, to community from a slightly different angle or lens. I find that these conversations are the types of things that we need to have more of in this world. And as I continue to figure out what the hell I'm doing with regards to this podcast, with my newsletter, I have some fantastic things coming up on the horizon for you, but I've got to figure out the balance between the purity and obscurity of doing this great work, but then actually having to front up and share it somehow and without becoming ensnared within the attention economy, which is so good at triggering me these days. So I'm still figuring that out. But in the meantime, enjoy this conversation that I have with Greg Dak, a.k.a. the Drunken Hobbit. And I'll see you sometime soon. Okay. Well, I'm gonna get into it, and you know what? You're going to have to just endure a good few minutes of me doing gentle praise in your direction as I introduce you. If you can weather that. All right, folks. Welcome to a special episode of the Fox Wizard podcast, A Questing Amidst the Meta Crisis and A Time Betwixt Worlds. I am so happy to be sharing this conversation with Gregory Dack with you. I've got Gregory right here. He's just going to be sitting, and as I kind of as I riff on his introduction, but then also provide you, the listener, with some wonderful context as to how this conversation came to be. So once we do that, and by the way, I'm not even sure if we'll do video or not. We're recording this with video. Maybe we'll have some snippets in video. It could be audio. We'll see. But yeah, do you want to say a quick hello, Greg, and then you can just endure my introduction?
Hello. It's really great to be here.
Fantastic. All right. So officially, Greg Dack has been a public sector security practitioner for more than 20 years and has successfully worked on security challenges and solutions ranging from small scale to national level. His approach is centered in curiosity and understanding what creates the security challenges communities face and how to develop and sustain approaches that work with the community. Greg sees security as one of the facets of the polycrisis and seeks to understand how security interacts with and is often a symptom of other facets. This approach supports solving not just a single symptom, but developing new approaches to enable and empower the communities they serve. So I love that, but it's also just a small snippet of the wonderful richness of Gregory Dack. Now, let me just share some more context. I don't know how long. This will be some of the first questions I ask. I don't know how long Greg's been a subscriber of the newsletter or how you first heard of me, but Greg is the person who I have a bunch of letters from, which is just so lovely. And they sit literally on my desk. They live on my desk. I've got 15% of my desk is dedicated to Gregory Dack constantly. I've been terrible at my response, but Greg's been so lovely, and it's just been such a lovely medium and way for us to keep in touch over the times. And the reason I thought this would be such a good conversation for you, our listeners, is because Greg brings this really exquisite and rare, in my mind, alchemy of deep savvy and sensibility when it comes to security, but coming from a warm, meta-crisis-informed or polycrisis-informed, complexity-informed, infinite game B, all of the good things brought into the context of security. And there's also deep, warm wisdom that is woven through this. I think you're third generation or something, or how many generations of funeral directors have you in your family?
So my dad, my grandfather, and my godfather were all funeral directors.
Oh, fantastic. So there's this deep a grounding in understanding grief and the full cycles of life. And so this is a beautiful segue into us. I mean, I just, Greg, see you as this wonderful, rare synthesis of warm, wise, and yet also pragmatic and grounded. You know, the context of security does not benefit from highfalutin philosophies like what I bring. There needs to be a kind of a pragmatic approach, but also we can't get too swept up in the pragmatism because we lose sight of it all. I don't know. How was the experience of hearing me introduce you just now? And if there are any particular facets you want to dive deeper or share some more perspective on, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I guess humbling is the first word that comes to mind, and I'm very kind of you to very touching that you think that way of, you know, what I've said and what I've written. And in terms of discovering sort of your philosophy and your thought and your work, it was actually through Michael Bungay Stainer and the Year of Living Brilliantly program.
Ah, yes.
Hi, I'm sorry. And I watched the video and was just so intrigued by, you know, the Fox Wizard persona and the ideas. And then I went and I looked up your website and then tried the Ritual of Becoming. And that's a really fantastically rich concept and reflection. And then, you know, just from there, enjoyed, you know, following the newsletter, following your writings and various podcasts, and got very confused for a little bit when you disappeared and sort of did your slash and burn of things to reset and refertilize the field. And, you know, just, yeah, I found what I liked was the innate curiosity and the asking more questions about what does this mean in the bigger situation, the bigger context, the bigger complexity of, you know, this wonderful world that we live on. Mm-hmm. And looking at what is it going to mean, not just today, like how do we solve today's symptom, problem, emergency, but what is this going to mean and how is this going to be relevant 5 years, 10 years down the road? What are we setting up or what are we prohibiting that will come up there where we're going to go, oh, that's not where we really wanted to go. And we went down this dead end, and you know, no, nobody's perfect. Nobody has a crystal ball. You have to explore and try different things. But I really liked how you lay that out and how you get people to think about, and if you're repeating the same thing, and I love that phrase about the Kraken of Doom catching up with you if you're not looking at what's going to be relevant, what's going to be necessary down the road, and what are you opening yourself to or your community to, and how do you do it, right?
I feel like when I reflect on How to Lead a Quest, which came out about 10 years ago with Kraken of Doom, I really thought that folks would orientate towards relevance realization, but I've since come to realize that salience is very powerful. Salience is that which is noticeable or attractive, and there is a willingness for so many folks to participate in bullshit that is indifferent to truth, because there's money to be made. And since writing How to Lead a Quest, I've become much more acutely aware of, to use the mythopoetic framing, of the influence of Moloch, where perverse incentives drive coordination failure. And I feel like this is something we're witnessing right now. And I'm going to do my best to try to avoid politics is going to leak its way through because it's unavoidable. But when I see what's happening in the world right now, it breaks my heart. I see what seems to my mind being this cascade of collapse into what feels like authoritarian dystopia, and the notion of security becoming toxicology, anything can be toxic at high enough doses. You know, water can be toxic at high enough doses. If you drink so much, your brain will swell, and masculinity and so on. Security is one of those things where I feel like, oh, if we kind of get a bit carried away here, what are we doing? And I'd love for you to use this analogy of something about, like, you know, you can create things to be super secure, but are we building a prison? Or you said something, you said it more elegantly, but I'd love to know your philosophy when we talk about security, because I can imagine some folks listening to this, and this is partly why I'm so excited. Some will be like, oh, hang on, what's this security? I mean, because I had this kind of cartoonish notion that, oh, security folks are just, you know, interested in the checkpoints and the guns and armor and all these other things. But of course, it's much more sophisticated and complex and considered. And so I'd love for you to share a bit of your stance and how you relate to security.
Sure. And I think you touched on a huge number of really useful points. So I'm going to try to unpack some of that.
Yeah, sorry. I tend to do that. This is our first time doing a recorded podcast. We're kind of like, that'll start off with a bit of question and answer thing, but we're going to dissolve this into, you know, banter and stuff. But this is a key point.
No, absolutely. So I think one of the first things that is really relevant is that you're right, that, you know, any any thing that is taken to an extreme tends to become toxic or problematic, right? And that is true of introspection. That is true of, you know, recklessness. Recklessness pretty quickly, but you have to take risks to enjoy life.
Yeah.
It's true of just about anything. So
sometimes it's even true of like philosophy, right? Like I love philosophy, I love wisdom, but sometimes I'm like, oh, fucking hell, God, just like these folks like pontificating and endless spirals of conversations. It's like it feels like you get to the point where you're missing the point.
I always liked, I've heard an anecdote and I can't remember who the philosophers were, but it was at Oxford. And one of them was arguing that we can't prove the existence of anything. And another one kicked a rock and said, I refute your argument thus.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, fair enough. And I think that's true in security, right? Like people want to feel secure. But if I asked you, what does the perfect, not necessarily perfect, because perfection is a problematic concept. But if I was to ask you, what sort of communities would you want to live in? Would you want to work in? You would probably describe things like you want to live somewhere where there's nature, where there's access to pathways, where there's interesting shops, where there might be a cafe or a restaurant you like, maybe a pub if you're like me. You'd want things like an interesting bookstore, maybe, or movie theaters, or, you know, and people would describe this for their workplace. Well, they want places where they can collaborate. They want places where they can do deep work. They want places that feel bright and alive. And we describe things like that. Nowhere in any of these descriptions do people say, I want, you know, a sniper tower on every corner, and I want 4 billion cameras, and I want the fence to be barbed wired off, and, you know, I want searchlights constantly checking my neighborhood that I live in. Those aren't things that we generally envision. So underlying what we want in our community is to feel secure. And I'm careful about not saying safe, simply because to me, and this is going to sound semantic or pedantic, but
oh, I love it. No,
bear with me for a sec. To me, if you look at, I'll use the example of a dark stairwell. A dark stairwell is unsafe because you might trip, you might fall, you might miss a step, you know, whatever. There might be, you know, a loose electrical cord that shocks you, something like that, your safety. It might also be a place where somebody's hiding so that they can grab you and hurt you. That, to me, is your security. So I try to avoid using the phrase safe because I'm not an expert in that field. I mean, arguably, security is so vast that nobody's actually a security expert. We all have like little slices or sections that we focus on. But I try to stay away from talking safety simply because if I'm trying to talk to something, I want to make sure it's something I can actually wrap my head around. Basic safety, sure, but and those often get confused. And I think that's part of the problem with the conversation about security is that define it, right? And if we come back to the communities that we just, or I just described, how does security fit into them, right? There's something about it that you feel secure in that space, but what does that mean, right? And that means really everything from like at the national security level that you're not worried that some foreign entity or is going to come in or, you know, domestic terrorists are going to attack you. Means that more of the local level that you're not worried about, you know, gang violence, you're not worried about kidnapping. It means, you know, and everything in between. It means, you know, if you're the shop owner, you're not worried about shoplifting because that obviously could make your business unprofitable, you know, all of these different elements that come together. It might mean at work, you know, making sure your technology isn't going to get hacked. So, you know, the thing you're trying to develop to blow away, you know, the audience doesn't get leaked and your competitor gets it. And all of that gets grouped into one word.
It's a little weird. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know some folks that work in cybersecurity and they're just, one of the constant things is like you never arrive. It's not like you can say, "Ah, finally now we're safe." It's like no, everything's constantly evolving and shifting. You got to, you know, it's almost like protocols and sensibilities that need to adapt to the shifting context. And good practice, of course, but but you just can't have that then switch into habituation, which then switches into, I guess, complacency.
Stagnation.
And comfort. And, yep. Yeah, yeah. There's a thread that you speak to, which evokes a concept that I got from the Listening Society, or maybe it was Nordic Ideology, which is the German word Gemeinschaft, mm-hmm. which is that neighborly conviviality, the collegiality, the camaraderie, the rapport, the sense of the fabric of relationality being warm and thick within a community, which seems a great direction to orientate to. And it seems like our world is moving the other way. We're getting ever more isolated. We don't know our neighbors. We're streaming. We're getting delivery to the door. And as a result, when we walk through our communities, more of it feels like we're with strangers, and as opposed to neighbors. And this is, I wonder how in your conversations, how does this land? Like, because the stuff that the fields that we're across are still relatively niche compared to widestream understandings. Like, I dare say, well, here's a simpler question. The distinction between a complex system and a complicated system, do you see that manifest a lot in security? Because my naive assertion would be a simple approach to security is to treat it like a closed system and to kind of fix all the security bits. But then a much more advanced one would be recognizing the complexity of it. I don't know. What, how do you relate to that?
I actually think, again, that you're hitting the nail right on the head, right, is that security is often the security concerns are often the symptoms of other things, right? Mm-hmm. It could be poverty, it could be mental health, it could be, frustration with governmental policy, it could be whatever the driver is that causes the harm, right, or the person to be motivated to do the harm. Mm-hmm. So, what you're really dealing with in security is, for the most part, you're dealing with the symptoms of a larger.
I just qualifiers. I just love it. Like, as in, like they'll hire Greg Dack. Greg, we need to fix security in this area, and be like, all right, well, let's reduce wealth inequality. Because that'd be amazing, right?
and I would love to. The way I see it is the goal of the security practitioner in a community, whether it's a work community or a living neighborhood community, is almost like an ER doctor. So when you come into the ER doctor and you've had, cardiac arrest, their role is to get the heart started again. But that doesn't solve the problem, right? Whatever it was that caused you to go into cardiac arrest, then you need the specialist and, the cardiologist and the physiotherapist and the dietitian and whatever else to fix the underlying problems. Otherwise, you're just going to end up right back and, that's kind of what security does or should do, is enable, and there's problems with the metaphor. Any metaphor breaks down over time, but it's to enable the community that it's working with to be able to identify, hey, these are the deeper problems that we need to focus on, and to give them the time where you're safe or secure to be able to focus on those, right? Because you're not going to be able to focus on those deeper problems if you're worried about somebody's going to break down your door, somebody's going to grab you off the street,
right.
Somebody's going to steal your stuff. So how do we empower that community to give them the opportunity to build a secure bubble to fix what they need to fix or address what they want to address so that they can get to where they want to be? So it's both, security itself isn't particularly complicated, but it's part of a complex structure. And when it's done in a healthy way, and this comes back to your earlier point, it's not something that I'm selling you. I'm not going to come in with a box of security, right? I don't even know what that would look like. I'm going to come in with some approaches, some techniques, maybe some tools. And I'm going to have to learn what this community wants. What's their risk tolerance? What do they like to do? What are they envisioning? And then talk to these tools can do these things. Here's some of the consequences of them that may not be what you want. So think it through. And then let's work together to develop something yeah. that you can then run, right?
I recognize a kindredness and the similar curse of the intellectually honest complexity practitioner in the sense that we share this, and I can imagine, just as in my profession as in many others, how easy it is to be out-competed in the short term by the folks that come in with a shiny new tool, or here's our AI surveillance thing, or here's our robotic thing, or here's that, and it looks like it ticks a box and it's great. It bypasses all of the important underlying questions, and in fact it probably just ignores what the community actually wants mm-hmm. and just goes into something that is a great kind of box ticked on a annual report or something like that. Because what you're suggesting here is what folks like Dave Snowden often bring in, the sensibilities with the Kinefin and the kind of the surfacing of the stories and understanding the substrate that we're working with. It's a process that is not an overnight solution or an off the shelf off the box thing.
Something that one of the things that drives me crazy, and I think it's probably the same in, as a complexity practitioner, when you're going into a company or working with a client, you're dealing with people who sell product, right? Mm. And there's nothing wrong with that, because inevitably some of these tools are quite useful when they're used the right way. But it's mistaking the tool for the solution.
Yeah.
If we install this, magical unicorn device, suddenly everything's secure. And the answer is, well, no, because something has to happen with that magical unicorn device. Somebody's got to do something when this goes off and spreads rainbows everywhere and takes out the bad guys. And, this has to interconnect with fixing the other problems, and this has to work in a way that doesn't make your neighborhood feel like Big Brother is everywhere. And so mistaking the tool for the solution is a big problem, right? Like, I can't imagine a builder going, you bought this house, so what we did was we put some sacks of concrete and some lumber and nails and screws, and here's a hammer and a screwdriver. There's your house, right?
Yeah.
You might be a little annoyed. Some people would love it, but you might be a little annoyed. But that's what you're competing with is, I'm going to sell you a solution that doesn't require you to do anything. It doesn't require you to change. It doesn't require you to be active. It doesn't require you to engage.
Oh, gosh.
Sounds perfect, right?
Are you seeing, as I am seeing, something AI, mm-hmm. ta-da, in terms of the security context?
Oh, yeah. We'll just put these feeds into AI and it'll pattern recognize. And, that movie that drives me batty, Minority Report.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we can predict this before it's even going to happen, and we'll intervene before the... And
gosh, I gotta be careful, but I have heard the line, because I'm trying to keep this, without... I don't want you to get in trouble talking with a heretic like myself, but I have heard the line used by a large private firm is that, we're doing a proactive or preventative strike because our analysis have said that they're, likely don't going to be committing some sort of offense, so we're going to get in early. And I was like, I don't know how that logic stacks. And I also don't know how that then, if we then start to extrapolate, if that's the multipolar trap that we are descending into, where it does seem to be an AI arms race, and then what are the second and third order effects of that? Does it then mean that it's down to how the software is evolving and updating as and you have this example of, I think this might be a great way to demonstrate the complexity of things and unintended consequences, the example of lighting. Would you like to expand upon that? I mean, you know that I don't like downlights.
neither do I. Yeah. And just briefly on what you were talking about the big firms and that, the irony of it is security measures, when they're effective, are preventative, right? The idea is to not have the incident or to minimize the impact of it.
Yeah.
But it's doing that in a human way, right? And what you're talking about with lighting is a great example of this is, you know, people will automatically go, oh, if you light something up, I feel safe and secure there, right? Mm. We're sort of hardwired that a lit space is a secure space, like a place you want, a place that's inviting to you to go, right? Because we can see what we're doing, which is a big plus. But if, you know, there's a problem, say, in a natural pathway through a park, and at night people have been running into problems. Well, if I light that, and that's my solution, oh, I'll light it up, it'll be great, people are going to feel more secure as they walk down there. The problem is the bad guy hiding in the bush can now see you coming from further away. And if there's no help anywhere nearby, when they grab you, that just means they can see what they're doing. Mm. And by lighting it up, my unintended consequence is I gave you a signal that said, this is the way I think you should travel. This is the safe path, right? Mm. So you have to be really careful and think through, what are you doing? And if you light it up bright enough, anybody who has a view on it is going to, like, what do you do at night? You want to sleep, you want it dark. You get heavy curtains and you close them. Well, that muffles sound too, right? So I may, even if there's people close, they're not going to see it. They're not going to hear it, right? And if you're closing, they're also not looking outside. So, you know, one of the principles you want is for neighbors to be aware of what's going on in a community, right? Mm. Well, if I'm not looking out once the sun goes down, which in a lot of the world, you know, can be multiple hours, like 12 plus at certain seasons. Now that whole area is not, you know, the community is not watching it. So who is? Well, okay, we'll put a camera up. Well, great. Now you've got a great image of somebody in a balaclava grabbing somebody. Right?
Oh, dear.
And I have nothing against cameras. I've used them a lot. But a camera in and of itself isn't a solution. It's a tool. So who's responding to it? Who's monitoring it? What's its triggers? Is it creating a sense that this community is under surveillance and maybe I'm not safe here, right? What are we doing with what we're using, right?
It's interesting. Just on the camera concept, Kim and I stayed in an Airbnb kind of thing. Not an Airbnb, just a homestay in Japan. And Japan's quite secure in terms of the default norms. There was a security camera at the front, and perhaps was to make guests feel secure. But it was plugged into a plug with a switch, so you could just literally switch it on and off if you were to reach up to it. What I'm curious about is, how does your mind work? Because extending the tendrils through the what ifs, the unintended consequences, and what else, that I find fascinating. But there's this part of me where this speaks to the privilege of being a cis male white, middle aged man, in that I don't often think about these things, which I'm sure that many women, when walking through at night and stuff, that would be active on their mind. And then there's also part of me that's like, I don't know if I want to think about this, like, because there's this really naive part of me that wants to just believe the best in everyone and kind of just, it's hard for me to imagine, like, someone having, but I can understand that intellectually. I can understand that, you know, you create conditions where there is poverty and then folks are forced to, you know, commit acts that are criminal in order to get funds, or maybe they're in a bad mental health loop or whatever the conditions are. But yeah, how do you manage that kind of, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do you be a seasoned security expert without becoming grizzled and distrusting of everyone around you, if that makes sense?
No, it does. It's an interesting question. So I certainly know a number of people in the security industry who have become grizzled and tremendously cynical and, you know, probably never see a good person. But I think that's the minority. I think the majority of them who are in are people who serve a community or serve an ideal because they believe in it, because they believe that they contribute something to making it a better place. And it's sort of an acceptance that bad stuff does happen. There are ill-intended people in the world for whatever reason. And I think to be good at it, to be truly good at it, you have to be humble enough to know I don't know everything. So, I mean, I'm fortunate enough. I know when I walk into a room, I am likely not the smartest person in that room, which is great because it means I can learn from the people who are there. And fairly early on in my career, I got an opportunity to work with some different groups of traditionally disempowered people. And I don't know if there's a better way to phrase that, so that's what I use. But, you know, similar to you, I'm a white, cisgendered male. You know, I speak the dominant language in this society I live in. I, you know, have had a fairly privileged life. But I've had the opportunity to work with community partners who represent a broad range of different experiences and who have flagged things to my attention that, I mean, if I had stood back and been like somehow completely open-minded, I would have probably gone, oh yeah, that could be seen. But because it's so far out of my context, it didn't cross my mind. And I'm fortunate enough to be able to have the opportunity to learn from that. And I think that's an important part, and I'm sure it's similar for you when you go to work with any, you know, organization. It's an important part of going in and learning the environment before you start to make recommendations, because you can do a lot of harm if you have no idea what's the vibe, what's the dance, what's the dynamic, what are people concerned about, how secure do they feel in this environment, do they feel like they can express themselves. You know, watch for, I like the way you phrase this, watch for what's in the penumbra. And I always mispronounce that, but, you know, what's in the shadows, what's in the edge, so that you can be attuned and go, okay, there may be something else. And then also be willing to go, and I can only run it down this far. Now, some of the teams I worked with, we used to joke a lot, you know, you'll know you're ready to start working in the industry when you have your tinfoil hat issued to you. because it is really easy to start to see everything is going to be bad, or every vulnerability or every risk. But then you have to sit there and go, but I still need to live. And I'm not going to live in a bubble wrap. I'm going to be out. I'm going to be walking around. I'm going to be doing stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's really no different than you take a risk every time you cross a street or every time you go for a swim or whatever, right? Any active, like, life is risk.
Yeah.
So understanding what that balance is, not just for you, but for the community and the environment that you're trying to serve, right? And then approaching them not as, and this is something that drives me nuts, but, you know, you don't want to approach it as a paternalistic, I'm the expert, here's your solution, because I don't own the solution. They do.
Yeah.
So here's some recommendations. Here's some ideas. What works for you? What resonates? What doesn't? How do we make something that works for the vibe and the dance of the community that you're in the environment that you're in, that will let you have the risk balance you want, that will let you do the things that you want to do, that will have the flexibility so that as you change, because you will, that it can change with you and flex with you, as opposed to this is, you know, if we're going to do this, it's solution 1-A-3 out of the checklist and, you know, make it work.
Right? I mean, obviously, your approach deeply resonates to all the sensibilities of a complexity practitioner, a wise practitioner. It resonates. There is a saying, I think Schmuttenberger talks about, that Daniel Schmuttenberger mentions, that intelligence often outcompetes wisdom. And I would imagine that the approach and the way that you offer, I guess I'm sharing, you know, what happens in my world too. We still come back to this thing of, It's a process that requires some patience or some willingness to hold complexity, And I just, you know, so then there's a question of how do you create the conditions where, what are ways that we create the conditions where we can have these conversations? Because in a world that is so busy and overworked and tired and distracted, the natural tendency is for us to favor the quick fixes, the familiar solutions, the box ticking things that seem to do a job. And there are many mercenary folks out there willing to capitalize on this. You said there's nothing bad having a product. I agree. And also, just to weave a little bit of Moloch in this, there is a bit of a perverse incentive. When you invested so much into something, you start to then see the need, and it kind of starts to become all the kind of solution space kind of somehow seems to morph to fit the product that you have. Whereas if you have epistemological humility, like you say, there are smarter people in the room, it is the disposition to have. It also means that some people will look at you and be like, well, what are you offering? Aren't you supposed to have all the answers? And so there's this weird thing, though, because we can't deny that there's sometimes a role that we have to play that maybe taps into some of those paternal energies, but we have to do it in such a warm and so ready to soften and dissolve way. I'm just like, I guess what I'm trying to cloud here in my question is how do you manage that dance? And, you know, if someone was to reach out to you and say, Greg, I feel like it's been too long since we've reviewed how we do security. Say there's a new, I don't even know the role that the person would have. They're looking at it and they're saying, I think it's been a while. I'm concerned by the path that we're going on. It doesn't seem to be producing results, or it does produce results, but I think we're measuring the wrong things. I don't even know what we need to be measuring here, but like, how do we even start? What's that look like?
So I think the first thing that I would say would be, I'm going to tell you some really hard things that you may not want to hear. And I think back to a podcast you did a while back where you talked about the importance of balance between, like, there's nothing wrong with paternal as long as it's a healthy balance of paternal, maternal, you know, all of the different aspects, and that you're not trying to dictate a particular path. So the first thing I would be telling them is, I'm going to tell you some really hard things. Number one is, the most valuable thing a security program can do for any neighborhood, any community, any business is to enable your people to do what they're supposed to be doing or what they want to be doing within that environment. And it is hard to measure how much a security program helps that. A healthy one, you shouldn't even really notice. The second thing is, the best KPI, and I hate KPIs, but, you know, simply because people become obsessive with measuring something and then they ignore anything else that's not being measured.
Goodhart's law. Once a measure becomes a target, it ceases to become a good measure.
But in the ideal world, I'd be able to tell you, well, you know, the security program prevented this many things. And the problem is that, you know, the ill-intended never come up and say, well, I was going to, you know, hold up that store, that person, or, you know, vandalize this, but your security program, I decided not to, right? So there really is no good metric. And I actually feel really bad for the police. Because they're certainly a security partner. But, you know, if crime rates go up, is it because things are getting worse, or is it because people are having faith in the police and actually reporting stuff? And, you know, the same with the security program. You roll out a new security program and you have an increase in incidents. Is it because the program's not working, or is it because people are actually feeling secure to report things and like something might happen? And then when the numbers go down, is that because your security program was actually effective, or was it because people became cynical and went, well, nothing changed, so I'm not reporting, right?
And there's potentially the positive feedback loops where you have more patrols in a particular area, so thus they find more stuff, which then warrants and justifies more patrols, and then you end up with communities
self-fulfilling.
That feel like they're getting, exactly.
So I think the other part that I would talk to, I would take that person, whoever it was, and normally that would be somebody involved in like whatever the operations is or the building or whatever, and walk them through, have them walk me through. So what you'll find in, and this is true whether it's a residential community or a business community, whatever, look for all of the unintended violations and workarounds of the security program.
Okay.
So if, you know, somebody comes through, and this is sort of your checkbox sort of thing, every door should be locked and access controlled. Great. I bet you that doesn't work for an operation. Or I bet you that doesn't work in a neighborhood. So look for where people have put a magnet over the door so that the latch can't go in. Look for where it's being held open with a fire extinguisher.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, because people will be people. They're going to find a pathway.
Yeah.
You know, you put a fence up because, you know, we're going to protect this park so that, you know, the kids are safe and, you know, parents can feel safe because there's only these two entranceways. Well, the kids don't necessarily want to go all the way around. So that fence is going to be peeled up. It's going to be climbed over. It's going to be, you know, broken. Look for those points and then go, okay, what does this tell you about the behavior and the program isn't aligned with how people are using the environment that they're in, right? And then pay attention to how much that's inhibiting people doing what they want to do, right? And then work from there. Okay, why do we need this locked if we can do this? Why do we need this fenced off? Or do we make this a formal entranceway so that it's a little more a projected sense of ownership, right? So that people feel like this is where I'm supposed to come in. This is okay. This is normal, right? Looking at what are you designing and how is it working with she's determined to be up there.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad she's with us. For those listening, how is, what was your cat's name? Sorry.
This one is Jelly, short Jelly. For jealous. And okay. She is appropriately named. The other one who's meandering around my feet repeatedly is Socks, and she will never go on camera. But
okay.
yes, hi. But this is, you know, part of that initial conversation is making them aware of those sorts of current things with the program and then asking them, what is it that are your actual concerns? Like, what are you trying to fix? What doesn't seem to be working? Because people will often say, well, I just don't feel secure. All right. I can't give you a magic bucket of secure. So walk me through what contributes to that. What is your, and this gets into the meta crisis quite often. Well, you know, everything's just falling apart. Well, I mean, I don't know any security device that's going to fix everything falling apart. You may need something a little bit different.
It does speak to you know, maybe softening our reliance upon any centralized system or any kind of established thing, given that within the fourth turning and the meta crisis, a lot of things are not as reliable as past. Then our focus perhaps becomes a little bit more decentralized. At least maybe this is me naively kind of projecting a wish upon it all. I can imagine the person who's, you know, in conversation with you, they would say something like, and this is interesting for me to notice this. I tend to, as I do a lot of work with corporate, I tend to kind of switch on my Moloch lens and try to see what are the tendrils of incentives here. And then once I have the incentive understanding worked out, I then switch that lens off and then open up what Dr. Zach Stein would call the eye of value, which is the more cosmo-erotic kind of sense of what does true value look like here, in the sense that a living whale in a living forest is more valuable than a dead whale in a dead forest, even though if we switch the other lens back on, Moloch can't see any value in a living forest. It's only valuable for the lumber it can produce. So when I'm looking at this guy, I reckon from a Moloch perspective, they're going to be like, I just need to make sure we can have a year where there are no incidences. We cannot afford to have any other security incidences. And they're thinking their reputation. They don't want to be on the news. They don't want any media. They don't want the production to be held back. They don't want, you know, whatever it is. And then I guess there's a way of like you're addressing or perhaps meeting that need, but then opening them up and warming them up to the bigger, the more expansive, the more, not just the intellect, but the heart and kind of what does it mean for for us to create the conditions in which people feel secure. Is that fair to say?
No, you're absolutely right. And what's interesting there is then, so that's another part of a good, healthy security program, is you're looking at resilience, which is an overused phrase, and anti-fragility. So it's almost like if you look at change management, you want to do some small experiments to see what works and what doesn't. In the security program, what you'd want to do is to set things up so that when bad things happen, because they will, is, you know, if you want zero incidents, then have zero people, zero technology, don't do anything, don't exist. Like, that's how you get to perfect security, right? But if you're going to accept that, you know, having people, having technology, doing something is inherently going to involve risk, because it does, then instead of going, we need absolute zero, look at what do we do to detect things early? What do we do to intervene early so that these things can be diverted before they become a big problem? What do we do to support ourselves, our staff, our residents, our neighbors, whatever it happens to be that you're working with, in such a way that when something bad happens, it's not, A, it's not unexpected, because nobody's walking around with some naive sense that no bad thing will ever happen. But number two is that how do we get together and talk through it, to grieve through it, because you do need to. That's human. And how do we either restore or learn and grow and evolve, depending on the nature of the incident and how severe it was and what it showed you about your operation? You may be able to restore back to, you know, what it was, because this wasn't something related to your operation. It was an anomaly. Or it may be something that fundamentally shows you need to shift something in what you're doing and how you're doing it, right? And that is part of a healthy security. It's debriefing afterwards. That's having, you know, the hot wash, they call it. So as soon afterwards as you possibly can. But also like a thought through retrospective after a little time's passed and people have been able to process. And if you've got a good program, you'll also know that witnesses are notoriously unreliable, which I'm sure you've run into in, you know, other aspects too, right? If you ask 20 people to describe the same event, you're going to get 21 different versions of the event. But collecting that and really focusing on what was the individual's experience through this, you know, situation or incident or whatever, and near misses where something's detected early and prevented, what does that make you, what can we learn from this? And again, this comes back to that difficulty of competing with somebody who's selling that magical unicorn device that'll solve all your problems and then they're gone, versus trying to sell them, you need to take ownership of this. You, your community needs to take ownership of this. I can, you know, provide some questions. I can provide some prompts. I can, you know, show you some models. I can answer questions about like particulars that you may not understand how they work or why or what the consequences of things have been shown to be. I prefer to just ask questions because, you know, then the community learns for themselves and that knowledge becomes much deeper ingrained. So then they're equipped to be able to do that and to function and to grow and to keep this thing relevant and, you know, to look at the infinite game, right? If you're living in a community, this community is likely to exist long after you move away or pass away. You want that. You don't want the thing to suddenly disappear when you're no longer here. Yeah. How do you set that up to be healthy, to be evolving, to be organic? And nothing that's going to do that can exist in isolation, right? This is a wonderfully complex world. And if you get excited about the complexity, because that's what makes it really interesting, also drives you nuts, but it makes it really interesting. Then you're seeing this as part of those solutions. You're seeing this as intertwined with the different things. You're seeing this as something that is a enabler, an empower, a strength that helps you to do things that you want to do, that you need to do, that you'd love to do, and not just you, but the next generation, 10 generations down, right?
Yeah, yeah, I love that. That was a beautiful disposition towards acknowledging the entanglement, the kind of what Donna Haraway would talk about in the Cthulhu scene, the sense of this is all fairly interconnected and intercontingent, and we got to figure our way through this mess. There are three things I want to cover as we begin our kind of transition. And we got time, but I'll highlight them at a high level. There's an analogy with a firefighter I want to talk about. There's a flipping of the client context, and then I want to talk about some of this grief stuff that you've mentioned and you have direct lineage of experience with. The firefighter example it's still another expression of I've got parents who've worked in the safety industry. I know of this situation where, you know, firefighters can do a lot to prevent fires, but gosh, the heroics of putting out fires, so much more appealing to what I would imagine to be like young men or folks kind of going in there and wanting to be the hero. And I wonder, you know, I can imagine there is the kind of the neophyte or the kind of young security apprentice that maybe having visions of them being the kind of the heroic security professional. And then there's perhaps the seasoned one that, you know, wants to create the conditions where they don't have to get out of bed to, you know, rush to a situation. You know what I mean? Is that something you witness?
Absolutely. What I find interesting is I think it's probably amplified in roles where people feel like they're some sort of first responder, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's true in almost every industry. And I'll use as an example, somebody in your field going in to consult with a business, and your first vision is probably, and I'm going to save this business and turn them around, and they're going to be, you know, the greatest business of all time and sustainable, and you know, and I'll drive that.
Yeah.
And then over time, you learn that, you know, I forget what the name for the triangle is, but, you know, the hero, villain, victim triangle, drama triangle. And you look at it and go, do I really want to play this role? And do I really want to enable these other roles to exist? Or do I want to step back and do something more like be a rogue, be a trickster, be a wizard, be a, shaman, be some sort of guide, be a hobbit, provide, you know, and that shift generally to me is a reflection of maturity, right? Like, how am I going to do the most good? And how am I going to contribute the most to the success of something bigger than myself? And do I really need, like, frankly, 5 generations from now, is anybody going to remember my name? Probably not. But that's true of almost everybody who exists. And once you come to terms with that and you're comfortable with that, then you can start to go, okay, so my ego doesn't need to be the hero. I can contribute in a much more meaningful long-term way by being this other role, right?
Yeah. I've been, both Kim and I have been quite deep into Bill Plotkin's world, Journey of Soul Initiation. There's a lot to be said about the dissolution of the adults as adolescent self and into the adult self. Carl Jung wrote about this. Anything before 40 is just research. There's consistently, it seems to be, well, I was trying to write about this and the distinction between ambition and vocation. There's a lot of folks that kind of still have a fairly adolescent need to be seen and to be recognized and to tick certain boxes. And that's, you know, there's a genuine need for them. But I would suggest that partly there's a maturing, a healing, a dissolving, or something that's required within them to enable them to kind of contribute in a more ecological rather than egotistical manner, which is, you know, the sensibilities that you bring to the fore. I wanted to just play something here one of the common conversations that happen with a lot of my friends with regards to meta crisis is we can't help but just think, okay, well, you know, if shit really goes bad and food security, energy security, all of these things start to come onto the radar, what does it look like? And under the commonality is always relationality. It's how do we foster and cultivate good local kinship and a sense where we are looking out for each other. I imagine that many of the sensibilities that you've shared here, because I've used the example of a client that may be having an operations and stuff, but say if there are, I mean, we can edit this out if it's too political. I'm so sorry. One of the things I was just like, I had the intention to avoid, and I seem to be deliberately courting it. Just, you know, the thing that you don't necessarily want, the way it works its way in. I guess, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say one more thing that's on my mind, and you don't have to make any comment or anything. I'm just like, that probably gives you a background context of where this came from. Then I want to segue into some grief and maybe a bit of a conversation of Samwise Gamgee and Drunken Hobbit. Unfortunately, there is this. I'm trying to extricate myself from these loops where I look at my phone and the algorithm feeds me such terrible scenes. And one of the many scenes of what I'm seeing is what's happening with. And I'm also seeing that I'm seeing the way the community is responding. And it's just, you don't need to make any comment here. Unless you feel compelled to, but I'm just seeing there's, within the complexity of it all, I'm seeing community rally together. I'm seeing what I would consider to perhaps be toxicity or the heavy-handedness or the malexpression of the approach. Some people have said, actually, I think Benita Roy says that the collapse of trustworthy media is perhaps a good part of our journey as a civilization towards being more multi-perspectival. So we don't look to singular points of truth, but we become better able to sense make together and to synthesize from multiple perspectives. So obviously we're not there yet, but I always appreciate these, more optimistic takes on what we're experiencing in the middle of now, which brings me to the comment on grief. Now, you've grown up in a context in which the ceremony and ritual of grief when we're talking in the context of funerals is something that you've lived with. I can't imagine what, I mean, from a developmental quickening perspective or at least, I don't know. I guess my question is, what was that like for you growing up being so close to death and departures and all of the grief that comes with that, whereas for many people they could spend the first, you know, two or three decades of their life without ever encountering it.
I guess it's a, how would I describe this? So I get, for some additional context, so my dad had a pretty bad accident. I was, you know, probably grade 5 or 6-ish, somewhere in there. And that meant he had to shift careers, and he ended up being the director of the local cemetery because he couldn't do funeral directing anymore. So, I mean, that part sort of came to an end, but then he continued on in that other aspect of that field. Hmm. I guess one of the weird things for me is, because that's what I grew up with, that to me was completely normal. There was nothing, right? I don't have a baseline comparator of what would it have been like to not versus, yeah. But it did cause some things that I know for sure is that it caused me to reflect a lot as a kid, and, you know, probably is why I do now. Just because those moments of reflection are just inherent. It strangely involved being really joyous about things. Because the people with the best sense of humor that I know were my grandfather and his brothers. My grandfather was the only funeral director, my godfather and my dad. And actually one of the local coroners who was a good friend of my parents, you know, their sense of humor was just wonderfully wicked and sharp and interesting. And, you know, they would sing nonsense, obviously not during funerals or anything like that where the family were there, but there was just always a lot of joy. And, you know, to see that as a response to knowing that death is inevitable, knowing that this is, you know, going to happen at some point, but choosing to embrace the joy of just being there, being alive, getting to live, and living a good and full life, right? That was something that was really important to me. So, you know, when bad stuff happens in my life, because bad stuff happens in everybody's life, it's not that you don't grieve, it's not that you don't feel it, but that you can accept that this is happening because you also can remember that the good happens. And to hold them in balance and to allow yourself to feel grief, to feel loss, to feel the sadness that comes with that. And then also to use that to enrichen the joys that you feel as well, right? Because I wonder sometimes the people who don't allow themselves to grieve, who try to pretend or move past it or, you know, skim over it or just don't ever, you know, I don't go there. I realize they can be happy, but can they actually be content? Can they actually feel true joy if you never deal with that stuff and you never unpack it, right? Maybe they can. Yeah. I don't know. But I would think you need to walk through that. And I think you need to do that, whether it's death, whether it's the loss of an ideal, whether it's the loss of a part of your life, you know, all of those sorts of things. When I was a kid, one of my best friends, he and his family were on vacation, and they came back, and somebody had broken into their house. Nothing major had been taken, some booze and stuff like that. But what I remember Jeremy talking about grieving was that loss of sense of security in your home, right? Losing a part of your life where home is secure and it's a safe place. And now maybe it isn't. But then also as they came through the grieving, fixed the door, put in a better lock, did a couple of other things, choosing to grieve through it, to feel that, and then to accept that the house isn't responsible for it. And that, you know, you are still safe and secure here. Bad stuff may happen, but this is still a place where this is home. And, you know, the dynamic shifted. It didn't go back to exactly what it was. It was one of those anti-fragile where it evolves into something else. But his family really enjoyed that house and stayed there for decades. I think that, you know, I know the parents have recently sold it, but, you know, it wasn't because they felt that violation. So I think that part of life, that acceptance of bad things will happen, but not a passive, like, Candide expression, but, you know, more of a allow yourself to grieve when it happens, allow yourself to understand that bad things will, and then moving on and finding the joy.
So wise.
Ironically, the best phrase I've ever heard to describe this was, and it wasn't necessarily about grief, but it works, was from a former staff sergeant who worked for me. And I forget what had happened. Something had gone wrong. Stuff does. And he looked at me and he said, "Boss, you know what? Sometimes in life, shit will happen. Now, you've got to make a decision. You can be fertilized by it or you can drown in it. What do you want to do?" So if you can view, you know, the grieving process, it's shit, but is it a fertilizer that will allow you to do something better, to grow, to become healthier, to open new doors, right?
There's often a term that we use as composting, like when we are metabolizing the grief. It's like a composting. It's the decomposition, and that's also part of ourselves that is, you know, not as composed, it's decomposition, but it frees up the energy for renewal as well. You speak to so many things that I'm only recently to. So you say that you don't really have a baseline. I'd say that the vast majority of the world population, at least from a Western perspective, has quite a denial of death and doesn't realize that life is terminal and we are all, one way or other, going to die. And the question then is, how do we want to live? Like, how do we want to go there? And it requires, you know, ambition is fine amongst the young, but it requires us to eventually make some sort of accord with the falsity of the ambition, or at least the hollowness of it, and then to tap into deeper vocational calling and the orientation to, I guess, a more, what I would call a poetic disposition to life, a sense of living into the richness of the relationality. And this is really quite timely for me. I've been, you know, Kim and I have been reading the work of Frances Weller, who wrote a book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, and which Frances says that one of the main elements of society is suppressed sorrow. We don't allow ourselves to grieve. We've suppressed it. And 366 days ago, I had a profound, it was a part of like a week-long profound plant medicine healing retreat where I experienced via psilocybin to go back a little bit before then, I was in a prolonged depressed chapter for quite a while. I wasn't feeling joy. The meta crisis, father figure having passed away, like a lot of these things were within me, and I'd intellectually processed it and put it in a box. But that wasn't true metabolizing, and there was no community container, so I was kind of like holding it all. I had this incredible outpouring of grief and then a return to the experience of joy once again. And I guess I'm just channeling this back to you because this was only a recent reminder for me. I think that perhaps for 20 years or even like the last 8 years, 10 years in particular, before the journey, medicine journey, I had kind of calcified and become intellectual and clever, but there was part of me that, just didn't feel or experience the fullness of what you described there. And
sort of a shield against the deeper emotional and
protecting from feelings So I think there's like, I don't know that this could be prescribed. I don't think that everyone can grow up in the context that you've quite experienced. But I deeply appreciate the warmth and the wisdom and the groundedness of how it's influenced and informs your perspective, and how that may translate. And it's just, it's a weird thing. It's like this anti-fragile sense. It's hard to wish grief for folks. You don't want that. It's like when it comes to, like, we know from our developmental lens, we know that traumatic events can be incredibly catalyzing for one's own development. We know that development largely works via entropy and support, but you also don't wish it upon people because, you know, these aren't great experiences, but at the same time they're part of the fabric of life. And I really, really deeply appreciate these threads that inform who you are. And there's one final domain that I'd like to talk about with you, and that is related to hobbits. There's Samwise Gamgee, who you consider to be a true hero, and I want to hear about that. I also want to hear about The Drunken Hobbit and where that came from, because I think that's so cool. I just want your you know, your business to be called Drunken Hobbit Security, because like it just evokes the perfect kind of vision of what security looks like.
Exactly what you want is a drunken hobbit to secure you. Yes.
Yeah. Get everyone in. Like, it's like a Bilbo Baggins' 111th birthday. It's like everyone's having a good time. It's like, yeah, that's the way.
So, ironically for me, these things are sort of linked. I've been a Tolkien fan since I was a small child, and my parents had a copy of The Hobbit. It's a coffee table book with wonderful illustrations and everything else. And I've always been fascinated by the story and I love the groundedness that hobbits represent, right? That whole fascination with, you know, good food and good companionship and good company and good conversation and that ability, because of the groundedness, to have a strength. You know, Gandalf at one point describes them, you know, tough as tree roots they can be, even though they look soft as butter or something like that. Mm. And, you know, it's just a fascinating concept. And, you know, Samwise Gamgee to me is like the ultimate superhero, because, you know, he really is humble. He's not the central heroic figure out in front. He's the one who just sort of shows up and does what needs to be done, not looking for the accolades. And I love that scene in Peter Jackson's movie version of it where he takes on orcs with a frying pan successfully. And then at the end, where he's building up the confidence to go and ask Rosie Cotton to dance and ultimately to marry him. And he takes the pint and, you know, swigs it back. And, you know, there's the confidence booster to go and do this. So the Drunken Hobbit concept comes from, at one point in time, I was looking to figure out what is the most jovial, happy, contented, grounded image I could conjure up, right? I needed something sort of like how you can play with the identity of Fox Wizard, something where I could play with this alter identity that if I wanted a different perspective.
Yeah.
Ironically, I've ended up using it for any time I'm playing on an online game or anything like that, because awesome. It's just a fun name to use. But so I pictured this, you know, that I couldn't think of anything more congenial and happy and interesting to talk to than a drunken hobbit. So it became a really great, and one should not bestow nicknames on oneself, but, you know, as an alter ego identity, I think totally. I can get away with it.
Yeah.
It just sort of came up from that. And like, I love the idea of a hobbit wannabe society.
Yeah.
Dedicated to good food, good conversation, good people, right?
Yeah.
Good connection.
Yeah, it's the Epicurean lifestyle. It's like, you know, surround yourself with good friends, good food, good work, you know, meaningful, good cheer. Like, and the thing is, like, a drunken hobbit, as opposed to a drunken dwarf or a drunken human and so on, there's something about the, you know, that it's going to kind of manifest in some sort of good cheer. Or even if there's a grumpiness, it's still good at heart. Like, it's just,
But you can't imagine like a violent drunk hobbit, right?
No,
it just doesn't work, right?
Yeah,
they're going to be laughing, singing,
that
sort of thing. Right?
God, this is part of my vague theory about security. Is I feel like, gosh, if we all had more local family friendly pubs, all kind of littered throughout the place, where everyone in the local community gathers together, because we've kind of overcorrected. We've gotten rid of the, you know, churches because, you know, with the fourth turning generational theory, we've overcorrected from that. But we've also then made it so that it's hard for folks to have small pubs, small local ones. They're all kind of big centralized things now, and not necessarily family friendly, but small local pubs. This is, I just feel like surely there are communities within Scotland or Ireland or places where people are coming together. They're singing, there's music, there's genuinely checking in with each other. And like that is a world that I would orientate towards. I mean, gosh.
I'm absolutely with you.
Yeah.
I had an experience like that in London, England, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So I was over there. It was related to work, and we were going to visit our counterparts and discuss, you know, how we do things. And I was at a pub meeting up with some friends that I knew from there, and they had small children. And this was fantastic because we're sitting in this pub that dates from like the 1600s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kids are sitting there and they're playing and whatever, and nobody minds. And at the end, we've had this really good lunch with, like, you know, really good beer. And we get up and we're walking out, and there's this group of soccer fans who might have been on the rougher edge. I guess football would be the proper term. Yeah. But on the slightly rougher edge near the entranceway. And as we were walking up, you could hear their discussion and their language shift. And they said, well, you know, what's your favorite Teletubby? And they were talking to each other about that. So the kids thought this was fantastic as we were walking through. And they probably switched back to whatever they were talking about before.
That's right.
But it was just this communal bonding. You know, this is a place where everybody who's here is a mate and a friend. And, you know, it was just really, really cool. So
gosh,
I'd love to have more places like that.
Yeah, totally. I've got friends that have taken their kids to there's a group here that do a rites of passage for young men, which has been largely having. Well, I'm going to do a very crude summary here, but maybe for a future discussion. But largely honoring of women. And then also there's this thing about young boys being seen, like properly seen by older men within the community that aren't directly related within the family. But there's something about strengths being acknowledged and the quality and character. And just within the interactions of the pub, the kind of communal spirit of knowing, oh, a kid's here, not that so appropriate. The natural shape-shifting and disposition that orientates towards that inclusivity. I love that. It's just it comes back to the Gemeinschaft, right? It comes back to this is like a lived experience of what it would mean to live in a secure community, at least from our perspective. I loved your example right at the start where you were talking about maybe there would be a bookstore or something. Monocle magazine, which is a magazine I'm ashamed by how much I like. They have this indicator of what makes for the best cities in the world. And one of the indicators is the number of independent bookstores.
Ooh, like, so I like that.
I like that as an indicator, right? But then they also have a Starbucks index as well, which is like, but let's say like too many stuff. What is it? It might be like independent cafes or something like that. Cafes to Starbucks kind of ratio. So kind of get a sense of like, do we have a kind of a diversity of small businesses? So you painted a really lovely scene there. We should probably wrap this up. I'm curious, like, as we think to this, you know, there will be a point where a week later or whenever this goes out, we're like, oh, I wish I had kind of mentioned that. Now, I just wonder, for folks listening to this, you have a sense of what my podcast is by far not a mainstream podcast. It's a fairly niche, warm, you know, curious, intelligent and wise readers and listeners this here. But do you have any final parting thoughts that you might want to leave or a question you might want to gift for folks to ponder or something that you might want to share that's on your mind? And it's okay if nothing comes to you, but if you have something.
No, that's a really good question. And I think what I would ask, and I would ask this of you as well, is right now, while we're all going through this insane time of all of the change that's going on, the meta crisis that's going on, all of these different pressures and attention draws and everything else, it's breaking down our ability to really feel secure in our communities, security in our environments, secure enough in a healthy way to really build the communities that we want to build. I would ask and love to hear about what small things do people think they could do? What small things would people like to take on? Because, you know, yeah, there's a lot of heavy lifting that needs to happen, but I think that the immense power of small things done by many people is often overlooked. And if you're going to build the communities, it's often those small things, those small gestures that will do that over time. So what is it that people are willing and interested in putting forward and going, I think this could help? Even if it seems naive, even if it seems, you know, I'm not talking Pollyanna stuff. I'm talking think like a hobbit. And
yes.
What would you want to do to make your home, your community, your workplace more like the Shire, right?
Oh, so good. So good. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to ponder that. And there's something I'm just so excited by this. I know that you've recently started, upon my encouragement, a microblog. I am a huge fan of, you know, the folks that are quietly cultivating, you know, and sharing some of their writing and thinking, particularly folks that haven't been corrupted by the need to perform within the attention economy. So you're not doing clickbait hooks or, you know, paywall tricks or things like that. It's
I don't even know how to do that, so I can't.
Yeah, exactly. So currently it's at greg-dack.micro.blog. It might be greg-dack.micro.blog. I'm going to, by the time, this might take me a week or two to get this up here, but I'm going to include a link to Greg's writing in the show notes to this episode. And I just want to say, Greg, thank you so much. Genuinely, the letters that I have received from you, the warm encouragement and the way that you've shown up. I mean, I have been through the dark forest. I've been through worlds of doubt and a kind of a period where I lost confidence in myself and my own center. And you were such a warm friend throughout that, and you helped to remind me of some of the value that I couldn't see. And I really appreciate how you've shown up for me as a friend throughout that. And it's been so nice to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you so much. It's always great to talk with you. And I'm just going to put this out there. If you're ever over this side of the water, there are a selection of whiskeys here, which I would love for you to try.
Ooh. Yeah, I'd love that.
You know, so please, if you ever get over this way.
And also, you are on my list of, once John Anthony and I get our act together, you're on our list of folks that I'd love to have join us for the Kindred Spirits, if we can get the timing right so it's a whiskey-appropriate hour for all of us. I think that would be wonderful.
It's always
the
whiskey-appropriate. Drunken Hobbit doesn't
Yeah. Fantastic.